thank you all for joining us. My name is Lori Fai, and I'm privileged to serve as Director of Policy Initiatives for the Michael and Susan Dell Foundation, headquartered in Austin. And I am could not be more delighted and a little bit intimidated, actually, by this very heavyweight panel we've got here and the topic that's before us this morning. So I'm going to briefly introduce the panel and the topics, and then we're actually going to dive in to a pretty robust set of questions. And you guys all have note cards on your chairs. We expect there's going to be a lot of questions come up in the course of the discussion today. And what we're going to try to do is actually attempt to group them together by theme so that we can run through as many questions or aspects of this issue as folks are interested in hearing more about. So Rebecca and the folks from Philanthropy Roundtable will be collecting those cards, so you can just jot notes as you think of questions that you have. So thanks to Rebecca and to Adam for a great conference so far, and for putting me in the position of getting to foster a conversation with these fantastic panelists up here. So I'm going to briefly tell you who they are in case they're somehow unknown to you. Joe Williams, many of you may know, is Executive Director for Democrats for Education Reform. So a former, he's actually a reporter turned political activist, and started his career in Milwaukee. Patricia Levesque is joining us. She's Executive Director of the Foundations for Education Excellence and Foundation for Florida's Future, public policy organizations started by former Governor Jeb Bush. And is very actively engaged, obviously, in what's gone on in Florida over the last several years, 10 probably, in education reform, and is continuing to chart those waters going forward. Tim Daly, many of you in the room probably know, with the New Teacher Project, has been at the forefront of really, in my view, really crystallizing the issues that relate to teacher quality and providing some remarkable paths forward for all of us who are seeking to understand and manage around these issues. And then Rick Berman, here to my left, is a very accomplished public affairs professional, but probably most interesting and maybe best known, at least for those of us in education, as the guy behind UnionFacts.com, which is an amazing resource and an amazing spotlight of transparency on the issues related to teacher unions and teacher contracts. So thank you guys, everyone, ladies and gentlemen, for being with me this morning. I thought what we would start by doing is just talk a little bit about teacher tenure, what it is, what it isn't, and what the issues actually are that are related to it, and why it's such a pivotal piece of the puzzle. So first, there are a couple of things that I think may warrant clarifying. One is there's no debate about the importance of a quality teacher in every classroom. However, there's quite a robust debate, as you all know, about how you actually accomplish that, who's effective, how you keep effective ones and dismiss ineffective ones. And one of the really that questions actually, as you know, has many systematic factors that affect it, not the least of which is the decisions around teacher tenure. And just to clarify a couple of things, there's often confusion about the difference between teacher tenure, teacher seniority, and some things like that. And it's important to understand what the differences are and how those decisions that have extremely long-tailed consequences are actually arrived at and who makes those choices. So teacher tenure is actually, as you guys may know, actually, you know what? I'm going to ask you, who knows what the definition of teacher tenure is? How many people? Ah, okay, good. So this is a question worth answering. So teacher tenure is actually the essentially a continuous contract. Once a teacher arrives at with acceptable performance, a certain tenure in the profession, they're actually granted a continuous contract. And so to undo that for teachers that are low performing is an extraordinarily long process. And it's different from seniority. So seniority would be the length of time someone's been teaching or teaching in a district, whereas tenure is a decision that's conveyed and has a really lifelong or potentially lifelong meaning in the life of a teacher. So the second thing that's actually really interesting, and I think particularly appropriate as the panel starts to get started on the on some of these questions is that that tenure, you will rarely find tenure mentioned in actual teacher contracts at the district level. That's because the policy around tenure and the laws that govern it are actually enacted at the state level. So states actually, state legislatures are in the position of making the decisions that drive teacher tenure, the length of time it takes for a teacher to arrive at tenure. In addition, they actually drive a dramatic majority of the issues that relate to teacher evaluation. And as we take a look at things, some of these slides we're going to look at in just a second about the landscape changes, the reason these slides are critically important and in understanding what the implications have been around the stimulus funding and Race to the Top, the competitive funds in particular, is that the, it is actually the states who are in the driver's seat of making some of those changes, removing obstacles that actually help facilitate identifying and keeping effective teachers in the classroom. So those are two key pieces of it. In addition, I mean, over the last, in particular, what would you say, Tim, last 2 years, there has probably been some of the most dramatic shifts in the landscape as it relates to teachers and issues governing teacher employment that we've seen in the last 30 or 100 years, which is sort of amazing. So one of the things actually Joe and I were talking about as we started is one of the challenges that we face, that I feel like I face all the time, is just staying up to date about what's actually going on and how quickly things are changing. So as you all probably know, over the last 15 months, the implementation of ARRA funds has driven a lot of behavior at the state level. So I'm from Texas, if you didn't guess by the accent. Even in our state, which is a right-to-work state and a state with a long and robust history of longitudinal data collection, it has driven behavior on the reporting side in some interesting ways. But more importantly, I think, to the topic for today, it's driven remarkable behavior at the state level as it relates to teacher evaluation decisions in particular. So we're sharing some slides, thanks to our friends at the New Teacher Project, about what's actually happened over the last year. And so you can see one of the critical things, as you guys know, is the ability to evaluate teachers based on student performance. And in many states, that has been prohibited, and in no state that I can think of has it been an actual systematic practice. So in 2009, this was there were five states, significant ones, as you can see, New York and California, that actually made it illegal and kept a firewall between student performance and teacher evaluations. Can we go to the next slide? I thought there was another one in between there. Oh, at the end of the Race to the Top application period, as you know, which created a whole flurry of activity in states, not a single one of those firewalls remained, meaning that the 14-plus million students in those states, including two of our most significant and largest states, actually have the ability for their teachers to be identified based on how well the teachers are actually performing with their students. Next slide. 12 states in that same process actually passed laws to improve evaluations and reverse the widget effect. Tim will talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but the widget effect is this effect of actually considering every teacher to be equal to every other teacher. No distinction, no accommodation for doing a great job, and no consequences for doing an abysmal job. So as these states have moved forward and changed, taken big steps to improve teacher evaluations, they stand to impact a significant number of our students as well. Is there one more slide? Nope, that's the end of them. So as we get started in this discussion, there are a couple of things. One, it's a thorny issue. It's a complicated issue. The political realities of the issue are significant. That's part of what we'll touch on today. And yet it's one that is at the heart of our ability to identify, reward, and retain effective teachers, and more importantly, to drive student impact for our students. So with that as a background, I want to talk a little bit with our panelists first about really how realistic is it that we can change teacher tenure as we know it, and how do we go forward from here? You want to start, Tim?
Sure. All right, I'm going to attempt to make a clumsy analogy of what tenure is like for the folks that that didn't raise their hands when Lori asked if you knew what tenure was. Tenure is to education sort of like what the filibuster is to the Senate. So it's an intentional construction meant to slow things down, to protect the rights of some group, in the case of the filibuster, the minority. And people often make it seem like it's the end of the story, that because of the filibuster you can't pass a bill, when it actually just raises the number of votes that it takes to pass a bill. So if you have 60 votes or you have 61 votes, the filibuster is completely irrelevant. You can do that all the time. Tenure is sort of like that in the sense that it's meant to slow down the dismissal process very explicitly to protect the rights of teachers. And oftentimes the amount of slowdown protection that it provides has the same effect that a filibuster sometimes provides, which is nothing gets passed. And in our case, no one gets dismissed. It doesn't mean that no one can get dismissed. It means that the burden has been raised to a level that typically is not met. So we can talk a bit about how we would change that, but we're entirely in control of where that burden gets set, just like Congress is in control of the filibuster. They could make it 75 votes, or they could get rid of the filibuster altogether. And very similar to tenure, they talk about it all the time, but it basically stays the same. That's kind of the way that tenure has been as well. Tenure has been controversial since it was introduced. So generally, tenure came into being around World War I, and it was meant to protect academic freedom of teachers. So this was a point in time where, you know, you could be dismissed for being a pregnant teacher, you could be dismissed for being old, you could be dismissed for being a member of a certain political party, which strangely some of our states still have laws on the books to that effect now. But it was meant to give people protection so they could do their teaching job without their outside identities essentially coming into play. Our legal framework is now totally different. So you can't fire people anymore for being female. You can't fire them for getting pregnant. So our civil rights law now performs many of the functions that teacher tenure performed. But as soon as tenure was introduced, it was immediately controversial. It's also important to understand that tenure was introduced decades before there were teachers' unions, decades before there was collective bargaining. So this was something that predates. Unions didn't like dream up tenure and introduce it into a contract somewhere. Something that in many cases was first introduced in universities and then migrated quickly to K-12. So it's important, I think, to have that context, not because unions aren't a significant part of this conversation, but historically it's important to understand that this wasn't a construct that came in with unions. I think it's entirely possible to change the way that we think about tenure and the way that we approach these questions. But we have to first understand that the reason tenure frustrates us is we want decisions to be made based on performance. And we're very frustrated that even when teachers tend to perform poorly, they still keep their jobs in almost every case. In most districts, and I don't say this to be crass, more teachers die on the job than are found to be ineffective in terms of performance. It's a staggering thing when half of our kids are performing well below grade level that you're more likely to die than be deemed ineffective. That is absolutely the truth in most of our urban districts. If we want to change the culture and make it more performance-oriented, the key point is that we have to generate information about performance that means something. There is no information about teacher performance that carries any weight. We have observations that principals do that, as we talked about in the widget effect, are essentially not all good. They're all great. So the principals are coming back and saying, we've evaluated the teachers and 99.9% of them are superior. So we have nothing there. In student data, we're starting to get somewhere with that, but we're only 2 years from a paradigm that Lori just explained to us where it was illegal to gather that data in many states. So we're brand new to this. Tenure's been around for almost 100 years, and only 100 years into it are we getting to the point where we're going to collect data about student growth and potentially use it for decisions. So the first step is, until we have real information on teacher performance that we can employ in this conversation, we're just arguing with one another and chasing our tail. It's a little bit like the way university admissions were done before there was standardized testing. So a long time ago, we decided that we couldn't make solid decisions about who should be let into college if we didn't have standardized tests, because we were relying on the recommendations of headmasters and principals and teachers, and they all wrote positive recommendations, and nobody had any idea whether an A from Omaha High School was the same as an A from Tulsa High School, so you weren't sure whether you should let the kid in or not. The introduction of standardized testing made everything more meritocratic, and it provided a common measure of student performance that plays a pretty big role in college admissions and has been accepted pretty commonly for a couple of decades. So what I would submit is we don't have any such data about teachers that anybody can believe, and the foundation of changing tenure is shifting from the argument to some kind of real stream of information.
Joe, is this worth doing, and why do you think it can be done?
So the for those of you who've seen the movie Waiting for Superman, you know, it's a very depressing movie that makes you, you know, sad and angry at the same time. But there's one moment in the film that's sort of the comic relief, when David Guggenheim spliced in some footage from The Simpsons television show, and it showed a teacher looking at her watch, realizing she was a few seconds away from getting tenure. As soon as she got to that point, she sat down and let this kid Ralph take over the class for a little bit. And he stood up there, and he's got a book held upside down, and he says, "Class, in what year was 1 + 1 = 2? And then he jumps out the window. I've seen the movie 30 times now about, and every time it gets a laugh in the theater. And the reason it's funny is because, you know, mainstream America right now, they get the joke. They get that tenure itself has become a joke over time. And I just mention this anecdote because I think it does suggest that the public is ready for this debate that's playing out right now. And I think it's one of the reasons we've seen the President of the United States decide that this was an area he's wanted to wade into, because he feels like he's on firm ground with it. So I do think the time is right. I think we're starting to see this stuff pop. I actually feel sorry for Tim's team, because I think they're going to have more work than they can handle helping states try to deal with this stuff. But I think, you know, as I shifted from being a journalist, where I had the freedom and the luxury of being able to sort of be absolutist, when I could just stand up there and say, tenure is bad, let's get rid of it. You know, now I'm more involved in trying to, figure out how you can manage the politics in a way that you can get something done. There's a lot of different ways you could go about trying to make this happen. I tend to think that, I don't think that just pummeling the unions into the ground and hoping they're going to go away on this is the most surefire way to get the kind of changes we're likely to be able to get in the short term. We were involved, along with Tim's group and others in Colorado this year in a tenure reform bill that passed there, Senate Bill 191. Which essentially said, you know, let's take all the things that we really hate about tenure and what it does to the system, and let's try to find a way to deal with those one by one, while essentially negotiating to keep tenure in place. Essentially, what happened in Colorado was an attempt to say, look, you guys can keep tenure if you want it, but let's make it meaningful. Rather than forcing or having the burden be on school districts to prove that a teacher is not up is not qualified to receive tenure, it basically said, we want to put the onus on systems to show that teachers are qualified, to say that we've really gone through this checklist to make sure that any teacher who gets tenure is deserving of it, so that it becomes more meaningful. But at the same time, sort of saying tenure doesn't mean you have a job for life. I think this is something that Michelle Rhee was able to put forth in the D.C. contract, to sort of say, if you want to have tenure, we can keep it there as a negotiating tool. But then to find ways to work around it, to essentially give the unions a way out of negotiating this. My worry is that if we make this an existential issue for the unions, no self-respecting union leader is going to deal on that, and they're going to have to fight it with everything that they've got. I think to the extent that groups that are out there on the edges that can continue to sort of pound on teacher unions while we try to get the deals done on this, I think that's the best way out.
Great. And nowhere has the sort of pace of change been more acute than what's gone on over the last few months in Florida. So we want to ask our colleague Patricia to tell us a little bit about that, what the attempt was, what the lessons learned were and what's the path forward as Florida looks at continuing to struggle with this?
Let me start by giving you some context on what was in the Florida legislation. I think there and Tim and Joe can talk more about all the different states that really tackled teacher quality, if you want to call teacher quality bills. They tried to tackle tenure and evaluations, and those were the two areas that seemed to be pretty common in all the different states. Florida not only tried to tackle tenure, what was in our bill was any new teacher hired after July 1 would be on annual contracts, period. Tenure wouldn't exist for any newly hired teacher. Florida also attempted to reform teacher evaluations. So 50% of a teacher's evaluation would be based on performance, and there would be some enforcement opportunities if districts didn't do their new evaluations correctly. Florida also took on things like colleges of education. If the state saw that the graduate, your students of your graduates weren't having progress, the state could shut down your college of education from being approved to operate. Florida took on differentiated pay. So if districts didn't collectively bargain more pay for teachers in low-income schools, more pay for teachers in shortage subject areas like physics or students with disability certification, that districts could receive financial penalties. They could lose some special pots of state funding. Florida took on recertification because we have 180,000 teachers. Our tenure reform was only prospective. So how do you get at the current 180,000 that exist? Florida attempted to say, if you can't show gains during your five-year teacher certification renewal process, you can't keep your state teaching certificate. You don't have a teaching certificate. It doesn't matter if you have tenure. You can't teach. So Florida tried to do a lot of things in one bill. In prior years, we had attempted to do really small things, like just take teacher tenure from teachers waiting 3 years to get it to waiting 5 years. Couldn't even get it heard. Couldn't even get the bill heard in our Senate. And then all of a sudden this year, we could get the bill passed in our moderate Senate, and they passed it in week three of a 9-week session. So how did we do it? There were a lot of things that came into play. I have to give credit to groups like the New Teacher Project and Education Trust and Dems for Ed Reform, all the groups that really brought teacher quality to the forefront of the conversation. Have to give credit to the Race to the Top for putting funds out there and making a fiscal reason for why states needed to act in order to draw down some funds. But then we also have to look at politics played a role. And in Florida, we had the president of our Senate was running for statewide office. He ignored our legislation 2 years prior. And now he was getting ready to go into a primary and really wanted my chair's endorsement. And when he asked for it, my boss said no, because you ignored the most important issue that was in front of the Florida legislature last session, and I'm not going to endorse you. That got his attention really fast. And so he wanted to get Governor Bush's endorsement. So we were able to use some political levers to get certain people who really could help the agenda move forward engaged. So the Florida Senate, who wouldn't even hear the bill the prior year, passed it off the Senate floor in week three of a 9-week session with no real pressure for why they had to move so quickly, but they did. The Florida House passed it the week after. So this is just unheard of before the midway point in a legislative session to have a bill that big pass and be sent to the governor. Now, lessons learned. Maybe we shouldn't have passed it so early because it gave our governor, who all during the process had said positive things. I support it. It's important bill. It's good for our kids. It seems like it's the right thing to be to happen. It gave him the opportunity to veto it and change his mind when politically his U.S. Senate campaign was going in the tank. And so that's the really brief story of what happened in Florida. And it was single-handedly the demise I think you can lay on our governor for vetoing it, making a political decision for a political race. But what were things that we didn't do well that we should have done better? Number one, we probably took on too much in one bill. And what I mean by that is we brought on opponents to the bill that weren't necessary. And one example is the College of Education reform. That probably could be done in a separate bill 2 years from now, and it would be effective. And we could pass it 2 years from now. It didn't need to be tied to the 10-year bill. And so opponents that came out quietly, they never, ever publicly got in front of a committee and testified against it, but private for-profit colleges that are typically your ally on things were opposed because they would come behind the scenes and tell you, we make a lot of money encouraging people to get their master's degree in education. And so they saw a future, you know, funding source starting to dissipate. So Kaiser University and some big for-profit colleges, you know, voiced concerns. Other things that we didn't anticipate, some folks that you would consider allies, like the Superintendents Association and the School Board Association, who, if you just dealt with tenure, you may be able to get them more on board with an issue because they want a little bit of an upper hand in the bargaining process, adding some of these other issues where they were going to get a financial hit if they didn't do pay a certain way, if they didn't provide performance pay or differentiated pay. It caused some of them to get upset in a year where they were already looking at budget cuts. So any hint of financial impact to them for not doing something else that you wanted them to do caused some angst, and therefore they couldn't stand up there with you on the legislation. Other lessons learned, I think we didn't do enough in anticipating how much the unions would do everything in their power to stop this bill. And so we caught them flat-footed. They never thought the Senate would get on board because they thought that the chair of the Senate Education Committee, former school board member, was like the Florida Teachers Union lawmaker of the year every time she was a member of the House of Representatives. They thought they had a lock on never having the bill move in the Senate. And so when the Senate president got her to see the light on getting the bill out of her committee, they saw that they didn't have any remedy or any way to stop the bill. And so what they ended up doing was getting the SEIU, AFSCME, every other union group in the state was wearing buttons with the Ghostbuster sign against Senate Bill 6. It wasn't just teachers' unions that were against it. Every public employee union in the state started getting excited about it. We didn't anticipate the money that they could raise quickly in order to fight the bill. And what I mean by that is they made commitments to people like our current governor. We're going to put $1 million into your U.S. Senate campaign or into helping if you veto the bill. We didn't have $1 million to offer the other direction. Not that we would have done that. But we didn't anticipate, I think, how quickly and how much misinformation would be spread rapidly about the legislation. There was not an honest discussion among teachers that the bill really was an opportunity for them to earn more money if they were effective. The unions blasted out information so fast on this bill is actually going to cut your current pay by 50%. And so when we didn't have the infrastructure set up to provide accurate information, that myth just perpetuated. And so you had teachers who normally might have stayed silent on the issue or wouldn't have even cared what was going on in Tallahassee. When they heard the lie, my pay is going to be cut in half, that's when they banded together to wear T-shirts, that said, ask me about Senate Bill 6 to their students. That's where they got students to write letters into the governor and call. You can listen to voicemail recordings to Governor Crist where you can hear the classroom kids talking in the background and a student getting on the phone saying, I'm against Senate Bill 6 because it's going to make my teacher lose her job next year and it's against charter schools, which had nothing to do with charter schools. But those were the things that we didn't anticipate. That's kind of the short summary of what happened in Florida.
Well, both Joe and Patricia have alluded to the impact of politics, which is inescapable, but also the influence, extraordinary influence of the unions in dealing with some of these issues. So, Rick, I'd love to ask you to offer your insights on really what is the role, what are we doing, you know, how do we actually... Can this get done? And what do you see as the light at the end of the tunnel from the perspective of shining more transparency on what unions do and how they do it?
Well, first of all, I'm intimidated by all the people up here who've been in this business a lot longer than I have when it comes to the education reform movement. But I come to it basically because I'm a labor lawyer that does public affairs. And about 4 years ago, I was asked if I could do something in this area that hadn't been done already. And the mission was, how do we get reform by convincing people that the teachers' union is not the same thing as teachers? And if you go up against the teachers' union, it's like going up against the nurses' union. People have an image of nurses, and you go and attack the union, and you've got a problem. And so we undertook, on behalf of a philanthropist, someone who I'm sure some of you know, to do a campaign in Newark, New Jersey. And it was one mission, and the mission was see if you can get people to see the teachers' union in a much more negative light than they are presently seen today. And the philanthropist did his own pre-test and post-test to see if we could move people's opinions. And I'll show you a couple of things that we did. But before I get to that, I want you to know that the answer is, yes, you can disassociate in people's minds teachers from the teachers' union. But before, as I say, I come back to giving you some evidence of it, I want to play off of some of the information that you've already heard. Politics has been mentioned more than once. And the process of changing tenure is a political problem. Tenure is basically evidence of political power. And if you're going to change tenure, you're going to have to change it inside a political construct. Patricia talked about the power of the teachers' unions. And whether their power comes from the image or their power comes from money, the fact is that they have the same kind of political power that lots of groups in this country have. They are not up against a formidable political enemy. This movement is not a formidable political enemy. This movement is made up of a lot of nice people. The unions are not particularly nice when push comes to shove. They are threatening. Nurses' unions are quite frankly quite the same thing. You see it in the healthcare reform area. The one thing that we have going for us that trumps money and which can trump the union's image if you go about separating, as I said, the image of the teachers from the unions themselves. The one thing that you can trump them with is is public opinion. The public doesn't understand what's going on. Superman has been a terrific jump start, or I should say a restart, in my opinion, to a conversation that's been out there for quite some time. But not that many people are going to see Superman. There are 300 million people in the United States. And if you discount a lot of young people and a lot of old people who aren't going to be part of the political process, there's still a lot of people that will never see the movie. And as much as I am a fan of the movie, and I'm a huge fan of the movie, reality says that over time, the stimulation that you get, the emotional stimulation that you get, the sympathy that you feel for the players in that movie has to dissipate over time. It just does. I mean, think of so many things that we've been exposed to. The earthquake in Haiti, you know, the amount of outpouring, the oil spill in the Gulf. I mean, the people in the Gulf still don't have businesses that got cratered. The people in Haiti are still living in tents. But it gets moved out because you can't maintain that kind of intensity. And the higher the level of intensity is for political purposes or emotional purposes in this case, the farther you have to fall. And so we have to find a way to sustain public opinion to trump the union's political power. If you want to change tenure, there is a map. There is a roadmap. And it starts with messaging. I mean, I'm sometimes fascinated when we talk about issues, things that I do obviously always have some narrative attached to it. And so think about the tenure movement. Lori asked how many people know about tenure. Go out on the street and ask 10 smart people what do they think about tenure. And they won't even know what ballpark you're in. Fact is, these are terms of art. These are not things that people understand. You know, you may remember, and some of you I'm sure will remember this given the crowd here, when the Republicans were trying to do something about the estate tax. And it never really got much traction in terms of trying to reduce the rate. And then we talked about the inheritance tax. And of course, look, most people don't have any anticipation of being the beneficiary of an estate any more than they do of being the beneficiary of an inheritance. But as soon as they changed the language to the death tax, everything changed. And that's a very, very simple example. And not to suggest that because you were going to die, you were personally going to get taxed, but it meant something to people. It was a word that they were comfortable with. It was a concept that seemed alien to them, and it certainly seemed worthy of attacking. So even in the simplest forms, you have to change the nature of the debate. And that means you have to reframe this whole issue of tenure. The problem needs to be reframed. And I'm not certain, one other observation, I'm not certain that from what I've observed, and again, I admit to being new to this, but sometimes there's a benefit in being new to something, there's fresh eyes. I'm not certain that we are hitting on the right buttons when we want public opinion on our side. And what I mean by that is this. When I do messaging campaigns on behalf of some of my clients, I suggest to them that rather than try to intellectualize ourselves into the debate, whatever the debate may be, is there a way that we can get into it at an emotional level? Is there a port of entry at the emotional level? Because emotions will stay with people longer than concepts. And if you think of the acronym FLAGS, F-L-A-G-S, there are five emotions that I'm always looking for. Fear, love, anger, greed, or sympathy. And out of those, and there's extensions of that, you know, greed just means is there something in it for me financially, et cetera. I don't mean it in a negative pejorative sense. But out of those emotions, when you come out of Superman, if you're analytical on an emotional level, you will say this movie is all about sympathy. And sympathy does not sustain itself. You forget about it. It's somebody else's problem. 80% of the people in this country do not live in households where there are kids in school. So it's not their problem. It's easy to feel sympathetic for somebody else's problem, but it's hard to sustain. What we need to do, if you want to attack tenure, is that we need to hit on fear and anger. Because fear and anger stays with people longer. And how you get the fear and anger is by reframing the problem, not necessarily taking away anything that's been said, because all of the sympathetic outpouring, I think, is good, and to the degree it can be sustained, it's better. But there are personal consequences to the other 80% of the people who don't have kids in their household, and the personal consequences are mentioned in the movie, but they are the tail on the dog of the movie, quite frankly. And that is the hollowing out of the intellectual capital in this country and the inability of this country to be able to compete with other countries when reading scores, math scores, science scores are falling behind Azerbaijan and other places that people couldn't find on a map if there was money involved. And that to me is where you start to get people to say, my God, we're going downhill here. And this is, now you get the business community really involved and talking about shifting jobs overseas because the jobs are going to go and the investment capital is going to go where there are people who can actually perform the work. That shifting, is what I think is an additive that needs to take place. And when, in doing so, I think you get around the unions by proving to people that there is something more important here than protecting tenure for some teachers. And by the way, lots of private sector, in fact, just about every private sector union, I can't think of an exception, although there may be one, every private sector union suffers from this. They have kids in school. Those people, you know, Teamsters have kids in school, and they don't have tenure. So why should somebody else have more than they have? The United Auto Workers didn't have tenure.
Do you have something you wanted to play?
Well,
at this point,
I can play this, you know, for comic relief if nothing else. Here's a radio ad. We ran this radio ad during the recent campaign in D.C. where Mayor Fenty and now Michelle Rhee were casualties. And all this is, by the way, if we talk about public opinion. If you want to separate the teachers from the teachers union, there's a branding issue that goes on here. Teachers union has a brand. This is not about the creating the fear and anger that I talked about. This is quite frankly something less than that, but you may find it interesting.
It's a step in the right direction.
It's a step in the right direction. It's a 1 minute radio commercial. Well, that didn't work. Can you back that up one back there? Okay. Well, it's not playing, and it played before. Here, I'll show you. This is from the newer campaign, and I'll just jump ahead. This was just showing people that the teachers' union was complicit, and we were giving the teachers' union an F. We had billboards. For some reason, can you advance it there? Because this isn't advancing. We had billboards in Newark, and if you go a little bit further, this was just to capture national attention. We put it in the right place.
Right in front.
Can you flip it one more time? This was Times Square. We did a contest that was pretty interesting. We put a contest out to vote, find the 10 worst unionized teachers in America who can't be fired. And we offered them $10,000 a piece if they would quit. And
that's the X prize?
Yeah. Now it actually made enormous. It got us enormous earned media because every local newscaster, you know, was sitting there at the desk at the 6 o'clock news, and one says to the other, "Did you hear about this campaign to find the 10 worst teachers in America?" And the other one says, "Yeah, well, my biology teacher in the sixth grade should have been in this one," and you know, it goes on like that. But if you flip one more slide, this is the interesting learning that I want you to see. I told you we did a pre and post polling test. Click it one more time. Moms who had kids in school had dropped their approval of teachers' union by 13 points, which is huge for a 3-month campaign. But here's the interesting part. If you were not a mom in school, because we had this tabbed, if you were not a mom with kids in school, it didn't move you much at all. Point is, if you don't have a dog in the fight, it's not your fight. It doesn't stay with you. And that's why we have to expand the universe of people who care about this by touching on these other issues, because the sympathy issue isn't strong enough to overcome the teachers' union momentum.
Yeah. So one of the things, well, several things that I've heard as you've all been talking, but clearly one of the things that you're pointing out so eloquently is that there are a variety of things we're not doing right. One is we're not entirely enlisting the right emotions and the right sets of folks. But what are some of the other things that we're not doing right as the collective sort of we that's represented in this room tries to tackle this issue and make some progress?
I'll pause at two things. One is we're not clear on what the goal is. So changing tenure or redefining it or getting rid of it, all of that is just a construct. We could end up with a different law or different name for it, which we do a lot in education, that has no difference. The goal, I think, is the attrition of ineffective teachers. So it doesn't make a difference if what we do doesn't have the impact of bad teachers not teaching kids anymore. And I think on that, keeping our eye on that ball is important, because if you call your local school district and say, could you tell me what was the retention rate from last school year to this year of the bottom quartile of teachers, they won't have any idea what the hell you're talking about. They will have no idea who the bottom quartile of teachers are, and they will have no idea why they should be tracking the retention of those folks separate from everyone else. So keep, I would say one is we need to redefine the goal. The second thing is, and I think Rick made this point pretty eloquently, we have to define what bad teaching is. Bad teaching, most people think, is indifference. It's the teacher that is not doing much, not showing up, not really giving assignments, who's kind of asleep at the desk. Maybe they're hostile and they insult the students. But the truth is that bad teaching looks quite different than that, and it's far more common. Bad teaching is generally a lack of instructional skill. The kids aren't learning. They're not responding. And one thing that we do respond to as a nation may not be the kind of inside baseball political stuff, but what we do respond to is the safety of children. And we absolutely rally. When a child goes missing in a community, there is nothing that gets everybody out of their house more quickly. I think we need to define bad teaching as harm against children, and we need to explain what that harm looks like and to say, this can't persist. This is not like 2-year process. Let the teacher keep teaching and maybe they'll get better. When really bad teaching is going on, it needs to be a cause for immediate intervention. And I don't think that we even talk about it that way. We talk about it as like the process.
Two things. I think in addition to the way Rick described as separating teachers from the teachers union, we have to separate the teachers unions from the politicians and really isolate the unions. And I think we're getting better at figuring out how best to do that. In New York this year, we did a campaign after doing polling statewide on the race at the top. We were trying to lift the cap on charter schools and improve our teacher evaluation system. We did a poll which not surprisingly found that 99% of New Yorkers didn't care about either issue. But we found that 90% of New Yorkers felt that if there was a chance for New York to win $700 million in a contest from the federal government at a time when we're laying off teachers statewide and parents of school kids are being asked to bring toilet paper into school because the school districts can't afford to buy toilet paper, that New York as a state ought to be doing everything it could possibly do to try to win that money. So we did a campaign statewide, radio, mail pieces, television, which basically accused the teachers union of blowing $700 million that could have come to New York. And we went to every member of the legislature saying, like, you guys are the ones who really blew it. You could have voted for all this stuff. We're going to hit the union on this, but just know we've got more money waiting, and you guys are next. And every single one of you is up for re-election this year. So if you guys want the mail pieces that we're going to be sending out in your district to say, thank you for standing up for kids, you can vote yes. If you want it saying, you know, at a time when we're laying off teachers, so-and-so, Senator so-and-so blew a chance to win $700 million from the federal government, you guys decide. And they came back and they all voted yes. At the end of the day, the second thing, though, is, and I you're referring to greed, made me think of this. We've got to give people a reason to want to get involved in the tenure fight, even if tenure isn't their issue. And I think I work with a lot of people who for whom choice is their main issue. And I think we've experienced this in places like Michigan, where our attempts to lift the cap on charter schools or create a permeable cap for successful charter schools in Michigan to have more charters come into the Detroit area was greatly helped by the fact that at the same time there was an effort to eliminate tenure entirely. I think, you know, when we're fighting choice battles with the unions in isolation, we sometimes think that this is major issue for the unions. You realize choice is nothing for the unions compared to the fights over tenure and the fights over using data to evaluate teachers. So if you can have both of them on the table at the same time, as we learned in Michigan, the charter stuff went right through. The union didn't even lift a finger trying to fight it because they put everything they had fighting this tenure battle. So I think, you know, trying to see the broader politics of this stuff, to see when you've got the union on defense trying to fight this, it gives you a lot of room. Even if you don't win the tenure fight, it gives you a lot of room to get a lot of other stuff done. Attached to that too, I think we need to, there are some major players that ought to be involved in this in a big way. And it's sort of become this elephant in the room in the education reform world. But Teach for America is an organization that, even if it officially as an organization, they can't get involved because it's advocacy and all isn't their thing. But there's a lot of people that support Teach for America that ought to be in on this fight. There's a lot of influential people that could help out tremendously. And just a plug for the charter school supporters. We did a campaign in New York this year also. It was a $1 million campaign to fight the last in, first out requirements in the state law. And at the time, New York City was looking to lay off 5,000-6,000 teachers, which would have meant the entire Teach for America core in New York City would have been wiped out because they had the least seniority. We couldn't get anybody from the Teach for America board in New York to support the effort. Thankfully, we were able to get charter school people who saw that fighting this fight at the same time we're trying to lift the cap on charter schools was ultimately going to help them. They are noticeably absent from this larger fight.
Rick, did you have something you wanted to add on that point?
The only thing I wanted to echo something that Joe just said. He mentioned the word offense. Too many times we do not play offense. We get engaged when there's an opportunity, but offense means you get prepared, you know where you're going, you amass enough resources to go do it, you're focused on something. Too many times we don't play the offensive game as well as people who really are trying to change the political process. And if you do it right, you present the union with a very, very formidable offense and you put them on their heels and you get the public to key into the debate. Getting the public to understand there's a debate out there is key, and you don't want to do it at the last minute. An offense has a long-term game plan. You put your game plan out there and you keep it going. Well, this radio ad's up again. You want to see if it plays?
Good morning, class.
Hey, what's that elephant doing in the classroom?
It's totally blocking my view of the chalkboard. How am I supposed to get a good education with this elephant in the way?
It's time we talked about the elephant in the room. The Washington Teachers Union is blocking necessary reforms for D.C.'s failing public schools. Tell teachers unions to get out of the way and let D.C. kids get a quality education. Learn more at teachersunionexposed.com.
We had to cut it off at the very end. We didn't have any more time. One of the kids was supposed to say, "And what's that smell?" but that's a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit of branding.
Yeah, and a little bit of an example of playing hardball offense, actually. Pretty hardball offense. But I do want to ask Patricia, because part of what you talked about in the Florida example were some of the things that you learned that you should have done better. And in particular, we have a question from the audience about what infrastructure you thought needed to be. And it's clearly related to the whole concept of really formulating a strong strategic offense game plan. What infrastructure should you have had, and how are you going to move forward?
I did tell you a lot of the mistakes that we made. We did a couple of things well, and that was this year for the first time, we have two very strong business groups in the state, the Florida Chamber of Commerce and then a group called the Council of 100, which is kind of the top CEOs in the state that get involved in policy. And for a very long time, they were only focused on higher education. So their emphasis at the state policy level was how many bachelor's degrees were being produced. And so it took us about 2 years to get them to see that if you don't have more kids graduating from high school, they're not going to be going to college to produce the bachelor's degrees. So getting the business community on board to see how they had to play a role in K-12 education, and they did. And so they came out with a report that was very supportive. They stood with us. And then what the business leaders did was they were able to engage local chambers on getting superintendents to sign up for Race to the Top. When many superintendents were reluctant or they were trying to put pressure on the unions not to sign on to Race to the Top, which in Florida, almost our entire plan was focused on the teacher issues. Now, when they did that, the unions also went on the attack to business leaders. So you have to be prepared, and we're more prepared for this next year. The teachers union actually started identifying the head of Bell's department stores, the head of Publix. And so they started encouraging teachers to boycott the grocery store Publix. Republic's boycott going to Bell's because the CEO came out in support of this bill. So getting your business leaders engaged, but also doing it in a way that where they're prepared for how it may impact their business. The things we didn't do were the public messaging. We need to do some more focus grouping in Florida on what are those messages that will resonate with the moms, with the folks that are interacting with the teachers each day. We needed to have our viral campaigns ready, and we're going to be prepared for next year. I think another thing that needs to be done is short condensing the issues that are on our bill so we can get more supporters from the Superintendents Association and others. And then going on the offense in a different way with the unions. As Joe mentioned, you know, they had a charter school bill and they had a, you know, teacher bill. And so the charter school bill kind of flew under the radar. How are we going to get the union spread out next year on the legislation? We're probably going to have a constitutional amendment dealing with Blaine and religious rights and money being able to flow to sectarian institutions that they hate. We're probably going to have a constitutional amendment being discussed, even if it doesn't pass, to go on the ballot for vouchers to keep them busy on that front. We're probably going to have paycheck protection, so that there's an affirmative checkoff if they want their dues collected to go for political issues. Probably going to discuss a disclosure bill, so that one thing that we have in Florida is all public unions have to disclose certain things. We require like 5 itty-bitty things. How many members do you have? You know, your overall revenue collections or something. But discussing having a disclosure bill that says, how much of your funds do you send out of state? How are your funds used? Things that they don't want to disclose. There's a discussion of bringing back an issue that we had in Florida that they killed a couple years ago. One of the main reasons teachers join the union is for liability insurance protection. Florida about 10 years ago started providing liability insurance protection for teachers and sending them an insurance card. Because we had 180,000 teachers, it cost us $4 per teacher. So less than $2 million to give them a card that gave them a reason not to join the union. The unions hated it. And so do we bring that back up? So do we spread them by playing offense next year on a variety of issues, especially when we've got the teacher tenure and evaluation bill in pretty good shape, and we just need to redraft it in a couple of ways. So there's a variety of things that we're going to try to do next year.
Divide and conquer. Mm-hmm. On some fronts. Tim, I want to ask you a couple of things. One, to weigh in on this conversation about what we're potentially not doing that we should be doing. In particular, you're accustomed to talking to rooms of folks like this. So what in particular should we be thinking about from a philanthropy standpoint to do? And second, really, where do we look for good examples of how this is actually working? You know, how teacher evaluation or productive progress on this issue is actually happening. And, of course, D.C. comes to mind, and as does Baltimore. So if you'd talk a little bit about those and others.
Sure. I think the first thing that we probably have to recognize is that we're massively underinvested in design, and that mistake is hurting us every day, and it won't be rectified easily. And what I mean is the door's wide open. We've got legislators that want to sponsor bills, and we've got groups that want to carry things, and there's nothing for them to carry because we have been not designing that stuff in recent years. So we've had an explosion of design that's quite positive in certain isolated places, but I want you to keep this in mind. Everything that Washington, D.C. did during the period of time that Michelle was there, from the contract to the evaluation system, was designed from scratch in-house by that group of people. There's no other district in the country that can replicate that level of capacity in such a short period of time. We should have lots of shops out there that are helping feed ideas to districts, because as we're hearing here, if the ideas are there, there are people listening, waiting to put those things forward. So there's a ton of issues. There's issues about how would you reorganize a district to manage an evaluation process that actually had some teeth to it. In D.C., they have they did this great new evaluation system this year. They had 35 master educators that they had to hire and train to do evaluations of teachers. They trained them for 6 weeks over the summer, and they did 2 weeks of observations with them before they were allowed to visit a single teacher. Most districts train their principals to do evaluations for one afternoon every couple of years. How did that training get designed? How did they put together 6 weeks of content for these people? So one thing that I think the philanthropic community should think about is we've funded organizations really well, including mine. We've been the beneficiary of this. There's been a real focus on brands and names and associated with that. We really need to move past that and think about funding design work so we're in a position to actually capitalize on this, because we are losing opportunities every day where inferior policies are brought forward because better ones just simply haven't made yet. And the second thing you said is where is good stuff going on? We learned a lot during the Race to the Top period with these legislative efforts. There were really, really interesting leaders came to the fore, and I think there was a baptism of sorts for some of the folks that carried these bills. In Colorado, which Joe mentioned, Michael Johnston, who was a young state senator, just appointed after his predecessor moved into the Obama administration. He's a Teach for America alum. The only way to describe his effort in this fight was heroic. This guy put up with threats, with people from his own caucus getting weak-kneed on him, and he said no to watering down this piece of legislation at least 40 times. It would have been so easy for a freshman in his position to back down, but one of the things that we learned from his effort is you keep your eye on the ball with the policy, and if it's not a better policy, you say no and keep pushing people, and in the end, he got the bill passed. So I think we've seen some good leadership politically there. I think Joe and his group in so many places across the country have shown how to organize this. I mean, what they did in New York is astounding. This is a state that passed a firewall law 2 years ago. 2 years ago, in the middle of the night, they inserted a data firewall that said you can't evaluate educators based on student achievement into a budget bill without a single hearing. And there it was in the law. And it was one of those moments where we realized how amateurish we were and how we had absolutely no game, that we could get treated this way and really could do nothing about it. 2 years later, the union supported the bill that repealed the firewall and mandated the connection of student achievement and educator evaluation. And that was due to the effort that Joe and his team put together that just completely changed the political dynamics. So I think the first thing is we need to invest in design. And the second thing is we need to start looking around the country to figure out operationally how are efforts like Florida and New York and other places getting put together, because it really is a matter of playing offense. We're not going to win this thing through the righteousness of our convictions.
Well, and how are things working actually productively at the district level so that you actually start to deal with some of the fears and concerns? But one of the things that it strikes me that we're only at the beginning stages of trying to do is actually what you set out to do, and that is to separate the teachers from the unions. So are there things, I mean, clearly there are aspects of that make some of us in philanthropy a little concerned and nervous, because like you so eloquently said, we're a bunch of nice people with, you know, the good of kids in our hearts. So what are some of the things that we're not sort of collectively thinking all the way through on turning up the heat on some of this?
Well, first of all, there's a million anecdotes that you can use. I mean, people don't want to read white papers. And if you produce white papers, you can assume that the only people that will read them are people that won't make a difference in this whole thing. This is not just this movement. I mean, I'm always amazed that business, you know, somebody attacking business puts out a bumper sticker that says these guys are a bunch of crooks, and 6 months later there's a white paper that says the bumper sticker's wrong. It doesn't really matter. And so you've got to play in the game where you can capture people's attention. Imagine for a moment, here's a thought. Imagine for a moment that we found out that 5% of all the air traffic controllers in this country were incompetent, but you didn't know which ones they were or which air traffic control tower they were in. I mean, there would be an enormous public opinion, a public opinion tsunami to do something about it. So what we haven't done is we haven't figured out how to pin the tail on the donkey. You know, I'll just tell you one thing that strikes me along this line to answer Laurie's question perhaps more dramatically. Here is, I got it, Tim, thank you. This was in the Washington Post. Some of you may have seen this past Sunday. This is the manifesto that was signed by Joel Klein and a number of other really top performing people who want there to be significant changes in the movement. And they mention unions all through here if you know code. But that's what you have to know. They mention the word labor in here one time. And yet it's all about the labor unions. So if we're not willing to call people out and to change the debate, you have to change the conversation in this country by changing the language so that people understand what you're talking about. And it doesn't mean you have to be nasty, but it does mean that, as I said, you have to pin the tail on the donkey. You have to say what's going on here. And until we do that, these guys will wait us out because the unions have money, they have bureaucracy, they're institutionalized, and they understand that right now they're in the middle of the firestorm that has been created by some of the smart people up here. But it doesn't last forever. And they can wait it out.
Actually, I don't know, Rick, if you can quote some of the numbers of just about the war chest that unions have and the cash that they actually put out into the market to influence what happens for their benefit.
Well, if you want to see how much money unions have, go to the website that Lori mentioned. You can go to teacherunionsexposed.com or unionfacts.com. And interestingly, talking about public opinion, I was just made aware of this the other day. If you go to Google and you type in teachers union, the number one hit on Google is the website that I just told you about. We are higher than the NEA and the AFT on their own websites. It's because of so many people going to the site, because Google uses an algorithm that basically rewards you for being higher up because more people are searching there. So go there, because I'll tell you who goes to a lot of these sites. The teachers go there. They want to see what's going on. The thing about the boycotts, They don't boycott anybody. I've seen this stuff before. Most of the teachers are in the union because they have to be in there, or, as Patricia said, because they can get some benefit, some fringe benefit. I remember, the big campaign against Walmart, and all the unions were saying, we're going to kill Walmart, we're boycotting Walmart, et cetera. Well, we go through the tax returns of all the unions to see where they're spending their money and all the things that they're doing. And we were finding in the tax returns that these guys were spending money at Walmart for their own internal staff needs, paper, pencils, whatever it may be. So, I mean, the point is, if you look at the amount of money that they have, it's enormous. The union spent $1 million in the DC campaign in the last few weeks to get Fenty out of there. And why did they want Fenty out of there? Because they wanted Michelle Rhee out of there. I mean, think about that they dumped $1 million. In fact, we just ran an ad in the newspaper today in DC, and it's kind of a reference to Michelle, and we have a Superman outfit on her, except it says R instead of S on there, and we said that she got killed off by $1 million worth of kryptonite. Because, for those of you who know anything about Superman, kryptonite was the only thing that could kill Superman. I see there's not a lot of comic book fans out here.
Yeah. Maybe they're just too young.
Well, I don't know. Too young or too old. I'm not sure which. But the point is they have an enormous amount of money, and the only way you trump money is with public opinion. I have done work for Philip Morris in the past, many, many years ago. They had more money and hired more lobbyists than anybody. If you had a pulse in Washington, you got hired by Philip Morris. Okay? They did not survive on their agenda with all that money because of public opinion. And it's a telling example.
That gives me some hope, actually, after that $221 million figure that I just read in an article in Education Next that teacher unions have put into campaigns. Yeah. I think, we don't have that kind of cash. Collectively, we don't put out that kind of cash, and we certainly don't put it all out in that particular direction over the course of 10 years. So we've got to pay attention to that stuff. So one last question, because we're actually almost out of time. For each of you, it's two-pronged. One, what are the things that you think we should be doing more of, in particular from the seat where we sit in philanthropy? And second, are there practical ways to create a counterbalance over time to the teacher unions? And how are those two things linked? So I don't know which one of you wants to start, but advice for us?
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about overall giving in that. I think what most of the folks in the room do really well is they give to great programs like KIPP and Dems for Ed Reform and Teach for America and those kind of things. And giving to the programs is fantastic. if at all, if I can make the case that if a portion of your giving can start going toward the bold, offensive policy advocacy, public messaging, you know, empowering some of these groups to be able to fight fire with fire. And I just want to give you a couple of things to think about. And don't get me wrong, I think funding the programs is needed. We have to have the funding of the programs. But just thinking about your public, your policy advocacy and getting involved in political campaigns. Mark Zuckerberg came out and is going to be giving $100 million to Newark, New Jersey, and it's fantastic. And I hope we have more CEOs who do that. But if you think about it in scale, he's going to spend $100 million over 5 years to help 40,000 students. And if you could take $100 million, I bet Joe could find 10 states where you could swing a couple of seats to have more education reform-minded individuals, and then put a little bit about that money into policy advocacy, and you could impact 10 million students. Just, you know, shifting a little bit of your focus. I think another thing to think through is how policy advocacy can have an impact when we're still building up the teaching core through Teach for America, when we're still doing some things. In Florida, we have 67 school districts. That means 67 superintendents. I've been in Florida for 15 years. I could count on one hand the number of, I'm not even going to call them reform-minded, I'm going to call them reform-leaning superintendents. And so, but yet, Florida moved in 10 years from being at the bottom nationally on student learning to now having our Hispanic students, if they were a state among themselves, beating the average student in 31 other states. Now, how did we get there in a decade when we have less than 5 reform-leaning, strategic thinking superintendents in the state? It's because policies were passed that forced incompetent, mediocre, and just nice people to do the right thing. They couldn't get around it. When you start grading their schools A, B, C, D, F, public pressure on them to do something about the F school is going to force them to start making some right decisions. So I would say helping fund the offensive, helping fund the public messaging, helping fund the groups that are going to be more strategic in campaigns, in the focus groups that are needed, in the political advocacy that has to take place, that's where you're going to help spread the impact of the programs that you're funding. They'll be more effective.
Two things very quickly. One doesn't cost a penny to the extent that you have relationships with your local superintendents, either directly through, you know, your foundations or whatever, or, you know, through business groups and whatnot. Encourage superintendents to do a better job of exploiting the threat of teacher layoffs. For some reason, a lot of superintendents don't like to say it publicly because it gets the union president on their doorstep the next morning. We went through this with Mayor Bloomberg, who is a very bold mayor. His political people did not want to mention the word layoff. We begged him to. We needed to have numbers out there. To say that 6,000 teachers in New York City are about to be you know, are in danger of being laid off, and for us to be able to point out that the union supporting both tenure and the sort of last hired, first fired mentality, it gets a lot of those younger teachers thinking that this union is not representing my interests here because I'm going to be one of those people who's going to be let go. The second one is along those lines. Support anything out there, whether it's Teach for America or any of the sort of the new teacher groups that are popping up, anything that's going to exploit the generational issue that exists. I mean, I always tell people when I was working in Milwaukee, and I go back to Milwaukee now, the Milwaukee Teachers Union still communicates with their members using mimeographed newsletters. And for any teacher under 30 that's communicating on Facebook and online and everything like that, it's just irrelevant. The generational split is working in our favor, and the unions are becoming increasingly irrelevant with them.
I think for philanthropy, you've got to keep taking risk and fund things that are anticipatory. Don't look at the landscape today, but think about where it's going. The organization that I work for, the New Teacher Project, was founded because of because Don Fisher gave a crazy 27-year-old Korean woman named Michelle Rhee a $750,000 loan. She'd never run anything in her life before. But that we wouldn't exist if somebody wasn't willing to take that kind of risk. And I think that sometimes we don't take risks as much. And if we want to win this kind of game, we need lots of efforts like that have some risk to them. And I think if we're going to win the long-term challenge with teachers, we have to remake the profession and offer something better than what's there now. I mean, our job fundamentally is to sell teaching as a job, and we can't sell it as it is now because it sucks. It's a boring profession that's demeaning, and it's infantilizing to teachers. It's depressing, and it's taken what should be the most beautiful job in our culture and made it something that's a lowest common denominator. And if we can't figure out how to remake this for the modern era so we can make teaching a job that the best people want to do, it doesn't matter how many blows we strike to tenure. This is still going to be a sector of our economy that we're ashamed of.
Rick?
Well, I suppose what I'm about to say I've already said in some other ways, but until you make the brand of the teachers' union more toxic than it is right now, and politicians who are supporting teacher unions and their agenda, because obviously you have to link the politician to the union agenda, which in turn is linked to the fact that our education system is ruining the country. We're hollowing out, as I said earlier, our intellectual capital. Until you make all those linkages for people, and you can do that with an air war. You can, and I don't mean on TV, but this is an overarching umbrella campaign so that when guys like Joe go in any particular community, at least people have been pre-sold. People already know that there are things wrong with the education system and the unions that control the education system, and so they're predisposed to hear the messages that Joe and other people on the ground are putting out there, and you don't have to start from scratch every time. But you've got people there who are willing to listen, and they understand the terms. They understand what you're talking about before you start talking.
Yeah, we want to improve the odds of the number of hands going up in the room.
Yeah.
About what is it and what's the problem we're trying to actually solve and why?
When you go out on the street and you ask 10 people what tenure is and they say, well, it's this about this, then you know you're there.
Then you're there. Well, I hope you'll join me in thanking our great panelists. They'll be sticking around.